Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn American English. We also tell you about important events that are happening around the world. Today we begin with China, where change appears to be happening in the court system. One woman has done something unusual. Then we're off to South Africa to hear about energy problems and interesting answers. Let's get started with part one. Protesters in China, for a long time, have asked the central government for help in fixing problems in their home communities. But in a recent case, a Chinese woman took legal action against the government, trying to force them to act. Anna Mateo reports.
A woman named Xia Runying lives in China's rural Jiangxi province. She says she was forced to have a sterilization operation. As a result, she lost the ability to have children. A Chinese court refused to hear her case. Law experts say it is the first time a Chinese citizen has sought damages from the government on the issue of forced sterilizations and abortions, treatments for ending pregnancies. The Chinese government is expected to reform its sterilization and forced abortions policies later this year. The experts say these reforms will likely make this case the first of many brought by Chinese citizens against the government. Feminist Voice is a women's rights organization in Beijing. Xiong Jing is a member of the group.
Actually, that happens to a lot of women, rural women in China. Xia was not the only case, but she was the first one to file a lawsuit to the government and to ask for a compensation. I think that's really important, and it may encourage some other women who have the same similar situation, and to urge the government to protect women's reproductive rights and their rights of informed choices.
Xia Runying says that in 2012, representatives of the Family Planning Committee in Dayuan County took her from her home to a hospital. She says they forced her and her husband to agree to a sterilization operation. She claims that forced sterilization is against Chinese law. She also claims the operation caused many health problems, including pain in her lower back and dizziness. 2 years after the surgery, Ms. Xia says doctors found damage to the veins of her lower abdomen. She took legal action against the family planning committee that forced her to have the surgery. She says she should be paid for medical costs and for psychological damage caused by the operation. The court that rejected the case said her medical problems are unrelated to the sterilization operation. Last year, China's National People's Congress approved an amendment to the Administrative Procedure Law. This change is expected to expand the rights of citizens to sue the government. Lawyer Susan Finder has been observing China's court system for more than 20 years. She says that while Ms. Xia's case was dismissed, it may lead to more reforms in the rule of law. Chinese state media say 13 million abortions are performed each year in China, and that number is rising. The number of abortions performed each year is up 30% in larger Chinese cities, such as Tianjin. I'm Anna Mateo.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. South Africa's state power system, Eskom, is struggling to meet demand for electricity in the country. The company has put in place an aggressive plan for limiting the amount of electricity it supplies to prevent a collapse of the electrical system. However, the unpredictability of the system is causing some South Africans to become self-sufficient. These people have begun producing energy in their own homes. Many are choosing renewable forms of energy. Mario Ritter has the story.
South African state power company Eskom has a big problem. The company provides about 95% of South Africa's electricity. But Eskom officials have said there is a strong probability of controlled power cuts almost every day for the next few months. They say the company may have to do this to avoid a total collapse of the system, known as an electrical grid. Observers say a number of problems are partly to blame. They include a failure to make much-needed repairs, a lack of investment, and non-cost-reflective tariffs or taxes. The company has added 7 million people to the electrical grid since 1994. Delays in building new power centers have meant that Eskom has overextended the operation of 27 old power plants. Some South Africans are considering other power sources to reduce their dependence on the electrical grid. Currently, renewable energy provides only about 2% of the country's power requirements. South Africa needs about 30,000 megawatts of electricity every day. Engineer Greg Ball lives in Johannesburg. He depends on Eskom to provide 5% of the power his family uses. Solar energy meets the rest of their demand for surplus electricity used to power 2 electric cars. He says it is good for the environment.
You have to start developing an environmental conscience. I don't want to be somebody that sort of goes through my whole career business doing just doing the same old, and then dumping all these issues and problems onto my kids. If we can make just a very small difference individually, collectively, it will be significant.
Some people say that taking oneself off the grid is only for people who can pay for it. Greg Ball spent over $30,000 placing solar technology equipment on his home. He says the technology has paid for itself. He says he saves about $7,500 in fuel every year. Starting costs are high, yet several solar companies in Johannesburg told VOA that recent power outages have helped create a notable increase in interest. Ryan Beach is part of a Go Green project for Parkhurst, a wealthy area in Johannesburg. The project aims to take 2,000 houses off the electrical grid and have them using renewable energy by 2020. He says we are currently looking at all the technology out there, from hydro to solar and wind. That would hurt local utility companies. Local governments earn about $2 billion a year from water and electricity. There is likely to be resistance to losing 2,000 customers, who pay some of the highest rates in the country. Energy experts say South Africa must seek cleaner energy and end its dependence on coal. South Africa is also the fourth largest coal exporting country in the world. Energy expert Chris Yelland argues the government should be looking at more environmentally friendly energy choices. He says there are a lot of good reasons why we should diversify away from coal, and also a lot of good reasons, in my opinion, to diversify away from a single monopoly electricity supplier. Eskom's financial problems could mean higher fees for customers in the future. That could cause more people to turn to renewable energy. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Jim Tedder. Thank you for joining us today. This is VOA, the voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Math is an important part of every American's education. How to use math for planning a budget or managing money, however, is not often in the curriculum. Some schools are starting to provide this training. Charles H. Flowers High School in Maryland has a financial literacy program that is designed to give young people money skills that will last a lifetime.
So today I want you to take out a sheet of paper and think about what is a budget.
Students in the class are dealing with numbers, but they are not studying math. They are learning basic, important information about finances with their teacher, Camilla P.
Many students choose to take this class because they see understanding about financial literacy can change their future.
One of the most important lessons is how to save money and make better financial decisions. Ms. P. says teaching money management to teenagers calls for creative methods. She says she wants to keep the class interesting.
It is an adult concept, so sometimes you have to kind of pull them in a little bit more. They don't want anyone to stand in front of them and lecture to them for an hour and a half. They want something that's relatable. If they don't see the connection, you lost them.
In this class, kids learn how to set priorities and make better financial decisions. That, of course, is not always easy.
We're trying to get them to make choices about later, not so much about now. And that is difficult because they see now. They don't really see the path of later.
Camilla P. teaches her students about the financial mistakes many adults make. These are mistakes that can create a lot of debt. Balancing a checkbook is one basic task that can help young and old manage their money. Another mistake has to do with credit. The students learn how paying only the minimum amount demanded by the bank will lead to debt balance increases. Most of her students now are able to recognize and avoid such actions. Ms. P. also advises her students to ask their parents how much they make and how they spend it. She says this helps make financial literacy become a part of everyday life. Camilla P. introduced the money management program at Charles H. Flowers 3 years ago. Last November, the teacher was honored for her efforts. The nonprofit financial literacy organization, Jumpstart, named Camilla P. the Personal Finance Educator of the Year. And that's the Economics Report from VOA Learning English. For more Learning English audio, subscribe to our podcast at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The United States began to expand west during the middle 1800s. People settled in the great open areas of the Dakotas, Utah, Wyoming, and California. The movement forced the nation to deal with great tribes of Native American Indians. The Indians had lived in the Western territories for hundreds of years. Settlers and cattle ranchers pushed the Indians out of their homelands. The result was a series of wars between the tribes and the federal government. This week in our series, Steve Ember and Sarah Long tell about some of these conflicts.
At first, the United States government had just one policy to deal with the Indians. It was brutal. Whenever white men wanted Indian land, the tribes were pushed farther west. If the Indians protested or tried to defend their land, they were destroyed with crushing force. By the middle 1800s, almost all the eastern Indians had been moved west of the Mississippi River. They were given land in Indian Territory in what is now the state of Oklahoma. The government described these Indians as civilized. This meant they were too weak to cause more trouble. Many agreed to follow the ways of the white men.
The Indians of the western grasslands were different. They refused to give up their way of life. These plains Indians were always on the move because they hunted buffalo, the American bison. They followed great groups of the animals across the grassy plains. At that time, there were millions of these animals in the American West. The Indians of the plains depended on the buffalo for almost everything they needed. Many of them were fierce fighters. The plains Indians did not want white men crossing their hunting lands. They often tried to destroy the wagon trains carrying settlers to California and Oregon.
The United States Army was given the job of keeping peace. Soldiers were sent to build roads and forts in the western plains. They tried to protect the wagon trains from Indian attacks. They tried to keep white settlers from invading Indian lands. There were many fights between the soldiers and the Plains Indians. The soldiers had more powerful weapons. They usually won.
Some Plains Indians tried to live peacefully with the white men. One such group was part of the Sioux tribe called Santee Sioux. It was the largest and most powerful group in the West. The Santee Sioux lived along the northeastern edge of the Great Plains in what is now the state of Minnesota. They signed treaties with the government, giving up 90% of their land. The Santee agreed to live in a small area. In exchange, the United States agreed to make yearly payments to the tribe. This made it possible for the Indians to buy food and other things from white traders.
Troubles started, however, in the summer of 1862. The government was late giving the Indians their yearly payment. As a result, the Indians lacked the money to buy food. The white traders refused to give the Indians credit to buy food. One trader said, "If they are hungry, let them eat grass." The Indians were hungry. Soon their hunger turned to anger. Finally, the local Indian chief called his men together. He gave the orders for war. Early the next morning, the tribe attacked the trading stores. Most of the traders were killed, including the man who had insulted the Indians. He was found with his mouth filled with grass. The governor of Minnesota sent a force of state soldiers to stop the Indian revolt. The soldiers had artillery. They killed several hundred Indians in battle. They hanged several others. Soon the revolt was over.
Trouble came next to parts of Colorado and Wyoming. This is where the Sioux Indians and the Cheyenne Indians lived. The chief of the Lakota Sioux tribe was named Red Cloud. The Indians fought bitterly to keep white men out of their hunting grounds. After 2 years of fighting, with many deaths on both sides, the government decided the struggle was too costly. It asked for peace. The Sioux and the Cheyenne agreed. They were given a large area of land north of Wyoming in the Dakota Territory. They also were given the right to use their old hunting lands farther north. The government agreed to close a road used by whites to cross the hunting grounds, and all soldiers were withdrawn from Sioux country.
The war ended, and peace came to the Sioux and the Cheyenne. With peace came a new United States policy toward other Indians of the West. The government decided to put aside an area of land for each tribe. The land was called a reservation. Each tribe would live on its own reservation. Most of the reservations were in Indian territory in what is now the state of Oklahoma. Other reservations were in Dakota, near the land of the Sioux.
The government believed it would cost less money and fewer lives to keep Indians on reservations. The Indians would be away from possible trouble with white settlers. Instead of moving freely over the plains to hunt buffalo, the Indians would live in one place. They would receive food and money from the government. Officials came from Washington to explain this new policy to the Indians. A big meeting was held. Chiefs representing many tribes attended. The chiefs spoke, one after another, to the government officials.
All of the chiefs said they, too, wished to live in peace with the white men. But many questioned the decision to move to reservations. One who did so was Chief Ten Bears of the Comanche tribe. He said, "There are things which you have said to me that I do not like. You said you wanted to put us on a reservation. You said you would build houses for us. I do not want your houses. I was born on the plains where the wind blows free, and there is nothing to break the light of the sun. I was born where everything breathed a free breath. I want to die there, not within walls."
So the government and the Indians reached a compromise. The tribes were given reservations in Indian territory. But they were also given permission to hunt buffalo in a wide area south of the reservations. The Indians agreed to give up all their old lands. They agreed to live in peace on the reservations. In exchange, the United States promised to give the Indians all the food, clothing, and other things they needed. It also promised to give them schools and medical care.
The Indians were not happy with this agreement. They did not want to give up their old ways of living. However, they saw they had no choice. The government was too strong. They waited weeks, then months, for help to move to the new reservations. They could not understand the delay in carrying out the agreement. The delay was in Washington, D.C. Congress could not agree on how much money to spend on the Indians. So the lawmakers refused to approve the agreement. They left the situation unsettled. Again, Indians were forced to watch angrily as white settlers began moving on to lands they had agreed to give up. As the whites moved in, the buffalo and other animals left. The Indians had difficulty finding food.
Soldiers shared their food with the Indians. It was not enough. Western officials sent urgent messages to Washington asking for supplies for the Indians. No supplies could be sent until Congress approved the money to buy them. As before, some of the Indians became angry and refused to wait any longer. Their anger led to new fighting. In the end, it was a fight that failed to win back their land. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
The program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Steve Ember and Sarah Long. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.